This is the Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams, and you've dialed into another one of our weekly episodes, which this week I think is our best effort ever. Do I say that a lot? But I think you'll appreciate what we are talking about this time. We start with that unexpected round of looting that once again took place in Chicago. There are a lot of tentacles to that conversation. We talk about how the mayor handled it, how the state's attorney handled it, what a local alderman has to say about it. And we absolutely do not solve the problem of violence in the city. We move on to face masks. The governor has sort of changed his position on this, or has he? And what do you know? Once again, some recommendations at the very end. Here's a recommendation. Go to the Joint Relief Institute if you've got knee pain. Remember, the Joint Relief Institute is in Orland Park and Oak Brook. It's the same phone number for either location, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. They use digital imaging to see where your tissue's worn away, and then they put a lubricant in there. I like to think of it as Jiffy Lube in your knee. Look, September's right around the corner. The weather, as I point out in the podcast this week, hasn't been all bad this year, even though we did have 7 tornadoes in one day. That's 2020 for you. A good day in 2020, 7 tornadoes. But there's still some nice weather to enjoy. And before it all goes away, I don't want you limping around on that knee. I want you to get out and enjoy it. So go to the Joint Relief Institute. Once again, the website, jointreliefinstitute.com. The phone number to call, 708-888-0000. As in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's August 13th, 2020, the worst year ever. It's 1:38 in the afternoon, and I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, live from the Tribune Newsroom for the first time in 3 months, and I just want to remind everybody that I am not out to hurt God.
Well, are you just taking pictures for when you leave?
No, I didn't have Wi-Fi after the windstorm.
Oh.
So I had to come in. I had some neighbors. I'd offered it, but my laptop wasn't hooked up. It's a long story, but here I am in the newsroom. I'm the only person here besides Jeremy Gorner, our intrepid cop reporter.
It's good to see you guys on Zoom and to hear you all. So let's get rolling. Since our last visit, there was a most bizarre, unexpected campaign of looting and violence across Chicago. Sunday afternoon, a young man was shot by police on the south side. That man survived. The word of the shooting, some mischaracterizing it as the shooting of an unarmed 15-year-old, spread rapidly, and by nightfall, violence erupted across the city, so that by the next morning, stores had been smashed throughout the downtown and to the near north side. So there's questions. Was this organized? The mayor says it was. By whom? We don't know. Were the vandals empowered by a general lack of prosecution by the state's attorney's office? Some people think so. And what's to keep this from happening again? On the upside, the weather's been nice. Austin, why don't you start? Like, what's the most...
Wait a minute. The weather's been nice. We had tornadoes in Chicago for the first time in 10 years.
7 tornadoes in one day.
37 years. City limits.
If you discount that, the weather's been really lovely.
I'm pulling up the video of my, this is my, right outside my window, my tree on fire.
Oh, wow.
That was earlier this week. A message from God.
Of the tornado or because of the violence?
I just like setting trees on fire. No, it was from the tornado. And it was terrible. Yeah, we lost power for a good 48 hours, but thankfully back to normal. I'm almost speechless when it comes to some of the looting stuff. So some things of note. Whether or not it was organized, there has been a lot of focus on that. And I'm not really sure why. I mean, if it was spontaneous, then it's still just as bad than if someone had organized it, I suppose. I will say that I was discouraged by, and I really enjoyed Eric's column on this. I thought Clarence Page had a really good column on it too. Black Lives Matter coming out and saying that they were in defense, or I should say one activist who represented Black Lives Matter saying that she was in support of the looters. And after that, protesters, including Black Lives Matter Chicago, going down to Englewood, seemingly against residents there who told them to get the hell out. And as someone who has, I have a Black Lives Matter sign at my apartment and it's still up, but it makes it hard to, because I totally disagree with those actions.
Well, it's one of the questions that I have is there a difference between Black Lives Matter with, you know, all the letters capitalized, and then or Black Lives Matter with just Black capitalized. And the saying, and my wife and I have had this conversation because we've got a sign in our window also, and the question is, do you support the sentiment behind it, which I think is a good one, which is to say that Black lives have too long been devalued in our society, and that, you know, by all of us, but especially by police, and some of the goals of this movement and the statements that they made in response to this looting, which I thought were extremely tone deaf, and they totally missed a moment where they could have come out and said, look, these are our goals, but this kind of, you know, Chicagoans waking up to these scenes on the streets of their downtown do not advance these goals. And we would encourage people to use peaceful protest rather than what you're seeing, which is a lot of justification. A lot of people saying, well, it's a powder keg and years of dispossession, years of poverty, and then on top of this, COVID has caused a powder keg. And even if that's true, which I think some of it is true, that it does create a great deal of tension, a great deal of angst in those communities. This is not going to advance the general cause of making that better. And yeah, it's just property, but you know, you can't make people feel guilty about not wanting to have their stuff stolen and the windows of their stores smashed. So it was a very depressing scene on Monday, and what compounded it was the response that too many people had, which was to try to excuse what was going on rather than to say, no, this is not how we're going to advance the cause that we're interested in.
Well, I live in the leafy suburbs where Black Lives Matter signs have been popping up, you know, more often than the happy birthday signs in the front yard. And I just think that the group really did themselves a disservice by their response, because I don't know that those signs are coming down, but I think, you know, they, after being dubbed or seen as maybe a radical group at the start, they had much of the country behind them, and coming out in support of the violence and the destruction, you know, that makes it tough.
I wonder if the spokesperson for Black Lives Matter is really speaking for Black Lives Matter. I mean, she's getting all.
They haven't really cleaned it up much, have they?
Yeah, but I'd like to know who's controlling their Twitter feed or their website, for that matter, Black Lives Matter Chicago, because I'm kind of with Eric. I don't know that what they're saying represents the movement, and who am I to tell Black Lives Matter what Black Lives Matter is all about? But if I had a sign in my yard, I think I'd be taking it down right now. I support what I believe to be the movement, but I don't support the notion that that's some form of reparations. They said that.
That's reparations. That is reparations. Anything they want to take, take it.
Or that it's okay those businesses have insurance. They said that.
Because these businesses have insurance.
Or that this is how these people eat.
If somebody decides to loot a Gucci or a Macy's or a Nike, because that makes sure that that person eats. That makes sure that that person has clothes.
That's a lie. That's not true either.
Well, in some of the places, apparently they looted the Ronald McDonald House and some other places and some small businesses. And you can say, well, okay, you know, we don't feel too terribly sorry for Gucci, but you know, there are a lot of businesses that got looted that are not Gucci, that are much smaller, and these businesses provide jobs for people. And if these businesses leave Michigan Avenue, they leave Chicago. If they say, you know, we're not going to try to do retail in Chicago anymore. Then those jobs will go away, and the tax base goes away, and the tax base is what supports some of the programs that we're going to need to boost these communities. So
remember State Street 20 or 25 years ago, where they were nothing but wig stores and stereo shops. You know,
yeah. I mean, yeah, I think it was more like 40 years ago, I think. But yeah, you're right.
I mean, I haven't been around 40 years, but I mean, I remember those shops. I got my first wig there.
I was going to say, is that where you got your wigs?
I want to go to John. I know you're driving, but Eric does it all the time. I'm interested in the organization of this and whether or not it's organized. And you seem to think it doesn't matter. And I think it does.
What sense? I guess if it was organized, you would be able to assign blame to a specific organizer. Well, or something. It seemed more spontaneous than anything to me. Like, organized in what sense? It seemed like people were saying, we're going to go loot downtown. Everybody go to downtown.
Brendan Riley, the 42nd Ward Alderman, said in May that they had evidence that this was organized, that there were all sorts of U-Haul trucks and other vans.
A lot of the U-Haul and vehicles that were used in the caravans were stolen a couple of days in advance from a handful of U-Haul lots and dealerships. We didn't get that information until long after. That requires coordination and organizing. You don't just organically see caravans of U-Hauls showing up half an hour or an hour after people on social media say, hey, let's go loot downtown.
Mayor Lightfoot told Time that this week, and then John talked to Alderman Riley again this just today. He said, I went out that night and I found a truck.
When I was out early on Sunday morning, we recovered an SUV with blown out tires, and it was a looting vehicle. It was clearly stolen. In the back of that SUV were stacks of bricks, stacks of rocks, a sledgehammer, and a professional glass cutting tool. Do you just pick that up on the way out the door, or are you ready a day or two in advance?
That's an organized sort of effort. And at first he said, you know, that it was organized. And then he said later it's anecdotal evidence. So I don't know that the police have any proof that it was. But the reason I feel, I don't feel good about any of it, but if we do have this sort of band of organized criminals fomenting disruption and using that as cover, I feel better than if we instead just have these spontaneous eruptions, right? So we all behave differently in a crowd. If the bad guys here can foment this bad crowd behavior and then under that cover steal in an organized way, that makes me feel less bad than if it just pops up out of nowhere. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the way I'm feeling.
I think it can be both, right? Like,
yes, I think, yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're under their cover, yeah.
Right. I mean, unemployment on the south and west sides of Chicago is at all-time highs. There's really, let's be honest, no end in sight of the pandemic. Kids aren't going back to in-person schooling anytime soon. And I think when you have those sort of conditions coupled with the fact that there were police officers who, by their own account, shot a man who were not wearing body cameras to record the interaction, which was really the opening that allowed all this misinformation to flow. You know, I think you're dealing with a situation where you've got a number of different sort of stressors and a number of different reasons why it turned into what it turned into. But, it's important to note that there are South and West Side neighborhoods that routinely deal with sort of, you know, significant instances of shootings and violence that we, as, you know, the news media, and I will hold myself accountable for this as well, we do not report in the way that we reported these incidents on the north side and downtown. And, you know, I don't doubt the fact that there's a segment of the community who says, look, our community is being brutalized on a daily basis. We'd like to share that pain. It doesn't make it right.
I'm bothered by the police department's, what they said about the body cams, that this was this new unit. And so not all the equipment had been distributed. I hope they're being honest, but it's like, well, I'm sure all the guns had been distributed. I'm sure the batons had been distributed. You know, I'm sure the vest had been distributed. Why is it that they were out there without the cameras having been distributed?
And I asked the mayor that question. I asked her who was responsible for sending officers without body cams to a report of a man with a gun in Englewood. And basically, her response was twofold. Well, we discovered this problem 10 days ago and we're working to correct it. Okay, well, that's not really about why that decision was made on Sunday. And then she blamed Rahm Emanuel for the last police contract, which basically requires every officer to have only one camera. So, for example, if I do a shift and then I sign out, my camera is dormant for when I'm not on duty. I don't get to hand it to Austin. Like, let's say his camera is broken. He can't use my camera because then there's chain of custody issues. If there's evidence on those body cams, and it's not as straightforward as you think.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate that they didn't get that on camera. And I'm hoping that there's some surveillance video
there's nothing
they can find. And my understanding, and I read this in one of the news stories as an allegation from a family member of the guy who was shot, that they did not, or maybe it was an attorney for the guy, but that they did not do gunshot residue tests on his hands. That would be a failure of policing not to get gunshot residue, because if they can establish this person had fired his weapon, that would go some distance in diffusing the situation here.
In a way, you guys are right, but in a way, really, none of this is about that. What this is about is the fact that the instigators were tweeting out that it was a 15-year-old, and whether or not there were body cam footage that day or not, that wouldn't have come out and it wouldn't have slowed down, I don't think,
so
what happened on Sunday.
Do you guys remember Harith Augustus? He was the South Shore barber who was shot by police after a confrontation in South Shore a year ago. So the police department, even though they have technically 60 days to release body cam footage, they released that footage the day of the incident because it was a similar situation where sort of social media was blowing up and there were sort of all of these sort of allegations, and they released that footage and it immediately lowered the temperature.
Well, Brenda Riley also said that he felt that had it not been for the incident, whatever happened Sunday afternoon, that the next wave of this was inevitable.
Do you think that the looting would have taken place Sunday night if that young man had not been shot Sunday afternoon?
I think that the folks that do the professional attacks on these retail corridors, if it weren't that, there would be another excuse within a day or two.
Okay, so you think it's inevitable?
I don't know that there's anything special about that particular incident. I think that it was something that was easily exploited by spreading a lot of misinformation.
Yeah, and his point and Alderman Hopkins' point, I think both were, regardless of what it was, the city was clearly unprepared. Downtown was completely overwhelmed. There was a few hundred officers. They couldn't stop all of this stuff.
I don't know what you would have done.
What
about
can you
that.
Do?
With the post-George Floyd stuff, you saw it coming. I'm not sure that the organization of the post-George Floyd stuff wasn't just people knowing it was coming and getting their stuff ready. We didn't see this one coming.
But Riley said they did in on Facebook posts and even on some gaming posts that they had some indication. And that's why he said he wants to invest in that and strengthen, beef that up.
That kind of technology, that sort of AI.
Right now we're fighting iPhones with a Commodore 64. We just don't have the technological capability to dig deep into these areas of the web where this stuff is planned and coordinated and where we'd be able to identify the people who are stirring up the hundreds and hundreds to come downtown.
And what do you guys think of the merits of the argument that this is from some level of lack of prosecution? Because I thought that Tribune analysis of Kim Fox's record was like sent from the heavens, that nobody seems to have done that work before. And it's what everybody's been waiting for an apples to apples comparison across administrations. And it certainly seems that the conviction rate is lower. The rate of cases that are being dismissed are higher, especially for violent felonies. I take the point that people aren't making the extraordinarily rational calculation of what are my odds exactly of whether I'm going to be punished for this. But over time, that does have an effect. And I don't think you can discount incentives when it comes to consequences.
Well, Kim Fox and John, you talk about Kim Fox. You talk to her.
She was taking the long view. She said that her attitude about not punishing too severely low-level criminals, she doesn't think that results in the kind of looting we saw again this week. She thinks that if you want to take the long view, you need to go lighter on those people and put your resources more in the more serious criminals.
And I don't know that I subscribe to the deterrent effect, because what we've seen this year seems very little is moving towards that deterrent effect.
And that if you just want to crack heads because of what you saw this week, the problem is going to perpetuate itself. You're never going to get out of this cycle.
And her point, too, is the fact that she doesn't want to take these small-time offenses and get people into the system to where they never get out. They never escape it. And so she's trying to be more lenient. Then now, Alderman Riley this morning on John's show said, well, that's not working.
The current system isn't working. And so I'm not looking to lay all the blame for this at Mrs. Fox's feet. That wouldn't be correct. But her failure to impose consequences for criminal activity, her piece of that equation, I am not satisfied with the job she is doing.
And secondarily, he said maybe showing these petty offenders that there are consequences, whether it's community service or whatever, and not just letting them free on their own would be a better deterrent than protecting them from the system.
That's what she was elected on, and that's totally fine. And I actually agree with that, not charging felonies for low-level crimes. There are really high-level serious crimes where her rates were lower than Anita Alvarez.
And I thought her response to that was really interesting in pointing out that up until, you know, her administration, Chicago and Cook counties had a relatively significant wrongful conviction problem. And if she's saying, look, if you're judging me just based on convictions versus convictions, she said it, I think that's misleading. She said, you know, I would hope that there were cases that were overturned for cause of innocence that I would not have brought. So it seems disingenuous to judge me for not bringing those cases that would have resulted in a wrongful conviction in the first place.
Yeah.
And again, she can't bring cases that are not presented to her by the Chicago Police Department. She's not out there doing the police work.
So okay, I think the most disingenuous thing she said, I think, was she said, look, the prosecutors don't set bail, judges set bail. That's a cop-out. I mean, it's true that judges do set bail, but prosecutors recommend bail or prosecutors fight for bail amounts. And, you know, so I don't think that her office is completely devoid of guilt in that.
Now, I agree with that, Steve. I do think that one of the things that I heard Kim say, I think it was on John's show, what she talked about the fact that you can't say that a failure to prosecute people who are looting at the end of May by now it can be held against her office. And a lot of these cases just, it's like, you know, the courts have been closed. You can't say that and you can't keep people locked up as many people have pointed out, it's against the Constitution. It's against the law to keep people, you know, to give them bail they can't afford. I mean, I say it's against the Constitution, against common sense to keep people locked up if they're not necessarily dangerous to the community. So I thought that was kind of a bad rap on her, that you need to give her more time to show whether her response to the riots at the end of May or the looting at the end of May is adequate.
It also can't be divorced from the fact that the courts were shut down until early July, so that these cases, even the most serious that she is prosecuting, are just beginning to sort of be scheduled for hearings and are working their ways through the system.
I think all of that is true and logical. I mean, it's logical, right? But I think Steve pointed out to her in our conversation, what I don't hear from you is anger.
We've not heard from you anger, or you talked about sadness yesterday, but you did. The typical prosecutor is going to come out and say, we are going to put these people in jail. We're going to see justice done. Lori Lightfoot said, we are coming after you. And that hasn't been your tone. And I just wonder if that is intentional.
I don't know that that's ever my tone. I think what we are seeing is my heart is broken. And the reality is that we can arrest and charge and prosecute as many of those people who were out there Sunday night. What I don't want to have happen is next month, the next batch of folks do this.
I think that played against her.
I agree, John.
But isn't it problematic to ask a black woman to publicly display anger? No, I mean, I'm honestly.
But Lori Lightfoot, maybe I'm alone on this panel, but I thought Lori Lightfoot's statement on Monday morning, you know, she came on TV at about like 8:30. I thought it was strong. It had that same sort of heartbroken thing, but she was angry about this.
And we're coming after you.
And to those who engaged in this criminal behavior, let's be clear. We are coming for you. We are already at work in finding you, and we intend to hold you accountable for your actions. I don't care. I do not care. Whatever justification was given for this.
Yeah, I thought she went over the top and she clapped back at was it Craig Wall she was getting at for
right.
She is too thin skinned. There's no question about it. But I thought that her remarks, her prepared remarks, had a nice tone, and I agree with John.
Hold on, Eric. Eric, you froze. And he agreed with me, my luck.
He was really going to agree with me, though. Lightfoot saying, we'll come after you was one thing. And Kim Fox, you just didn't have that. And, I mean, you can do both. You can be very sad. We're all very sad. But you can also say that this is not acceptable. We will not allow this. And we will prosecute, you know, to the fullest extent of the law.
Okay, but do you guys think, and Eric's clicked out, he'll rejoin us here in a second. Do you think that when that's story was going down. So Monday morning, do you think that Kim Fox right away went, oh, wow, this is going to be all over me? It's amazing to me how fast that story went from looting in the streets to Kim Fox did not handle the post-George Floyd stuff well. And it didn't help that the coincidence of the Tribune story was about her prosecution rate. But
that was what Lori Lightfoot did. Like, I, you know, Lori Lightfoot's a smart politician.
She put it there.
She did not, you know, stumble into that. Like, that was her strategy for that press conference.
And I call upon our state's attorney and our courts to make sure that these individuals who are arrested and those to come are held accountable. Put your best people on this. We have made the case. We have the video. We have the officer testimony. These people need to be held accountable and not cycled through the system.
I don't think you're wrong in suggesting that it worked. It was much easier to talk about some other politician's purported failure than sort of the systemic problems out there.
That's fair, Heather. I mean, was that is that a smart play or a fair play? I mean, is that the right play for the mayor to immediately give it to Kim Fox then?
I think it's an interesting question because it was not a response that I think it was very different from Kim Fox's position. And in some ways, Kim Fox is a much more progressive politician than Lori Lightfoot is. And I think it really shows you sort of how in Chicago, you know, we don't really, you know, have a right wing, but we have a more progressive and more moderate Democratic wing. And I think that really sort of was a very clear demonstration.
To look like Fox doesn't care.
I don't know that it came off as she didn't care. I think she was disputing the premise that the proper response to a wave of looting was to lock a whole bunch of people up.
Kim Fox is Preckwinkle's protege, right? And so yes. How much of this is a proxy war between Lightfoot and Preckwinkle? But the second thing, Eric, I'm interested in your answer because I think you've been around longer than any of us in the city, is do you remember a time when the mayor and the state's attorney were so publicly at odds? I don't know that I do.
I don't, especially given that they're in the same party. The proxy war between Preckwinkle and Lightfoot was 175-25 by Lightfoot last year. So I don't think that that's really an issue. I think that those two are probably both looking for a way to get along. And I would not think this is part of that. I just think it's a question of somebody looking to make somebody else wear the jacket for it, that you had Superintendent Brown and Lightfoot on the podium together, and they didn't want to point at each other. So they pointed at the person who was off stage. Right. I mean, that's essentially what happened there. And again, I would like to see is it true that any of the people who were arrested so far in the Sunday night, Monday morning looting, were they people who had been arrested back in late May?
We asked her these that. We asked her that, and she said it was too soon to know.
It may still be too soon, you know, but, you know, so if you can say, well, gee, these people who we, and then you got to make a case that we should have kept them locked up. And again, you don't do that. You can't, you know, the law says that you can't give someone an unaffordable bail for, you know, essentially a property crime.
No, but so, if you did dismiss the charges, I think that's different. I mean, if it's
I think a lot of these charges probably haven't been dismissed yet. I don't think they've been dealt with yet, a lot of them, but are these the same people, or is this just is there a message? And I think that's maybe the broader question is Kim Fox's policies sending a message to people that we're not going to take seriously anything other than like violent crime against people? Everything else, you know, we will slap your wrist and go away. The statistic in that Tribune story that bothered me the most was Kim Fox's failure to prosecute escapes. And, you know, it's not the classic, you know, sawing through the bars with a file found in a birthday cake. These are people who cut off their electronic monitors. And apparently this happens quite a lot, and Fox's office has not prosecuted those. And that, it seems to me that electronic monitoring is maybe a key to a lot of the problems we have of locking up people for too long for too many offenses. But if she's not taking that seriously, that's something that really jumped out at me in that story.
Yeah. If you want to have effective bail reform, you need to have some way to make sure that people show up back to court. And clearly that wasn't working. And that clearly there's not enough consequences if you're not. I think there's Will Lee at the Tribune has had awesome tweet threads, as he always does, of bond court. And one of the stories that really stood out to me is he talked to, there was a guy who the judge was setting bond for, who said this, it was his first arrest, 25-year-old guy wound up in a jewelry store handing items off to people. The cops came, he ran off and ran right into the 18th district commander and knocking her over, and she arrested him. He said it's the first time he's done anything like this. It was his first arrest. If we want Lightfoot to wear the jacket for something, because I think there is plenty of blame to go around here. One of the things recently talked about news stories about Kim Fox, the dreadful lack of compliance with the federal consent decree between the city, between the federal government and CPD. There's like 70% of those metrics aren't being met. Lightfoot needs to be on top of that and talking about solutions to that. And really, I think her policing solutions have been pretty bad and really hasn't gotten anything done. And that falls on city council too.
Last week, I said that it would be easier if the mask mandate in Illinois applied to everyone everywhere all the time. Enforcement would be simplified. There'd be no gray area. If you're walking alone over the Michigan Avenue Bridge, you have to have a mask on. The governor has now ordered essentially that if someone walks by you on the bridge, you have to have a mask on. Steve Bertrand, your witness.
I really thought that was the policy all along. And when I walk across the bridge, the Columbus Avenue Bridge, I have my mask around my neck until I come upon someone and then I pull it up.
I think people perceive that as social distancing, Steve, that if you're two of you sharing a sidewalk, I walked by people today that didn't have a mask on. They went right by me. I happen to have one on. It doesn't matter. Right. We're outside. We're on a broad city sidewalk. And as I understand the governor, he's saying no. In that circumstance, you both have to have a mask on.
Well, let me just say this. I got tested this week for COVID-19. And so I was asking my doctor about that very question, or some random doctor. And he said, you know, he said that there is a slight chance of walking, but, you know, technically it's you know, if someone were to cough just as you came across them, maybe you could get it that way. But that's a pretty difficult thing to do. But I thought we were supposed to, I thought when you're within 6 feet of someone, you have a mask on outside or inside.
So that has been the order all along. What's different is there's a new enforcement mechanism that Pritzker got passed this week. And it essentially says that businesses are now being forcefully deputized to police this.
Yeah.
And if they don't, they face Class A misdemeanor, $2,500 fine. And I think as someone who is extremely pro-mask and think everybody should wear masks all the time, I think that's irresponsible, and I think it's tone deaf to the needs of small businesses right now. The state should do its job. If you want to if you want to have a mask mandate, you want to have a rule, let the state enforce it. But putting that on the backs of businesses is really tough, especially when you see, like, you're forcing these poor people to go up to imbeciles in their restaurants and potentially get in, like, really violent confrontations. Someone in Michigan died from one of those confrontations. And instead of the state, like, enforcing this on an individual level, you're forcing it on the business level. And that seems really, really tone deaf at a time when businesses are facing.
Which is more effective, Austin? I mean, which is more effective to, if you put it on the individual, you're going to have a business owner call the cops every time someone comes in. Is that effective, or is it more effective to say, look, I can't serve you unless you have a mask on?
I think it's a question of fairness and responsibility. And I think the responsibility, lots of big retailers have mask orders because they can afford to hire people that, you know, stand at the door and check if everybody's wearing their mask and stuff. It's not feasible for a lot of these places, especially when they're not making any money.
I get the feeling that this order is not going to be enforced too strictly, but that what it does is it empowers mm-hmm. someone who is in business. My daughter works in retail now, and she, you know, as in on the floor of the store, she's able to tell people, look, you know, make them, she can roll her eyes, whatever she wants to say, like, look, I know the law is that we can get fined $2,500, so I have to ask you to put on a mask or leave. I think that's more empowering for a small business owner than, say, having to say, it's our rule to do this, or the law says you have to do this.
I think
there's a difference in tone. And yep. And I believe that John raised this exact idea on our show last Thursday, and Governor Pritzker must have been listening, because it was the next day, John, I sent you an email saying Pritzker must be listening to you, because it was like you suggested that very idea. And And I got to say, I want to see how it's actually implemented and see whether it works. But I like the idea. And again, Austin, it's not because I want to pick on the business person. I want to give the business person the tool, the lever to be able to get someone to wear a mask by saying, like, and it's kind of like, I'll shut up in a second. It's kind of like the rule that says that a convenience store owner can be fined if he or she sells cigarettes to a minor. And that inspires everybody in the store not to sell cigarettes to minors, to really be good about the ID thing. And I don't think that that's too hard on the business to ask them that. But
if I can interrupt you, I think I can feel the concern from all of you. I should tell you I did test negative. Thank you very much.
We assumed you didn't bury the lead.
Okay.
But so the other thing that Pritzker did on the day when he announced those rules was to sign a law that makes assaulting a retail worker who tells you to put on a mask or otherwise follow public health guidance a felony. And I think that's part of it.
Kim Fox is going to prosecute that.
And it also gives retail workers access to more paid leave if they end up getting sick. So, I mean, there's a strategy there, but I think Austin's right that you can't talk sense to stupid, which is where we all find ourselves.
And I think it would help if we're talking about like the authority of the law, if this was actually done in a democratic way. All of this stuff is still being passed through emergency rules. This rule went through an obscure rulemaking body where you don't need a majority of people to pass it. You need a majority of people to prevent it from happening. That's the only way it stops. And he continues to govern this way.
What was the vote? It was like, that's the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules in Springfield. And it survived 6-5 or something like that.
There's 12 members, 6 Dems, 6 Republicans. And you need 8 of the 12 to vote to kill it.
Well, with respect to the way they were going to execute the 25, it's up to a $2,500 fine for the business if the patrons aren't complying by the rules. And the way I read that, they first come in and they give you a warning and to the like the owner or to the individual. And then they come back a second time and they warn you again. And then the third time they can issue a ticket to the owner of the establishment.
Correct.
That's kind of like dram shop. If I get drunk in your bar, then the bartender or the owner of the bar is liable. And so I sort of understand putting the onus on the business rather than the individual. The more I think about that, the less I like it. A, I think if the authorities, whoever they are, show up, they should write a ticket on the spot, not 3 warnings. And if anything, both of them should get a ticket. I mean, how do you not give the ticket to the dum-dum that won't abide by the rules?
The way this rule works, and it's all a question of how it's applied, but it's also like don't pass rules where you don't know exactly how it's going to be applied. If you're outside in Southern Illinois at a restaurant and someone has some person who doesn't care about masks, has his mask off, is playing cornhole or something, a health official can go warn the business owner about that, and then they can come back. If they're coming back to ticket the business for one person not wearing a mask, just ticket the person.
Yeah.
Why is that on the business to go out there and enforce that?
I've got a cousin who's driving a RV around the country. And John, you should really talk to him on your show.
Yeah.
Because he's been to 9 of the 10 hotspots so far. He's going through the South and, you know,
storm chaser.
Florida, and it's just amazing. It's just amazing how they react differently. You know, like in Florida, you know, we don't wear masks. And so he was coming into Southern Illinois. And as he came in to Southern Illinois, he had to stop at some store or something. And he goes to the door of the store and he's like, oh, geez, I forgot I'm in Illinois. I need a mask to go inside. So he goes back to the RV, gets his mask, then goes back inside the door. And the woman in the shop said, did you walk to the door and then go back and get your mask? And he said, yeah, because we're in Illinois and you need to wear a mask inside. And she said, oh, honey, that's just in Chicago. You don't have to worry about that here.
There's a reason that Chicago is no longer Illinois' center of the pandemic anymore.
So Michigan started releasing data on the settings of outbreaks. And it's really helpful because it shows you exactly where these cases are happening that have been identified by the state. And Illinois, to my knowledge, no one has pointed out to me where we're releasing that data. And that would help a lot.
Yeah.
There was the county that was on the warning list in Illinois. And it's like, well, how could this have been? And it was because there was a single outbreak at a meatpacking plant. And that's the sort of thing was like, well, where did this come from? We would know if they were doing what Michigan was doing.
Well, were there examples, Austin, you can relate? Like, are they talking wedding receptions or school assemblies? What were they talking about?
It was more settings like long-term care, restaurant patron or restaurant worker, manufacturing, like meatpacking. Like the example Steve said, if we saw that on our, and they also broke it down by region. So they have like 25 regions. You could see exactly which settings that they're happening in. Obviously, we know this already, but the most prevalent by far is nursing and long-term care facilities. But in the entire state of Michigan, there was only one identified case of a patron at a restaurant spreading it.
Wow.
So, which was really surprising. But having that on a regional level, I think would help regional health authorities. It would help everybody if we knew that.
It's an open question to me whether Illinois' contact tracing efforts are robust enough to produce that sort of data, at least in Chicago, which is what I've been following. The full scope of the program funded by the federal government won't be up and running for another month.
Well, Heather, I took the red line in today, and I try and take it at least once a week. And then I relate to my listeners what my experience was and what the death toll was. And, you know, you pretty much, there's 10 or fewer people per rail car. Everybody's catty corner. Nobody's sharing a bench. It's very open. But then I'm always checking out the mask use. And on my L ride today, there was a woman who was sitting across from me and over. She didn't have a mask on. And she wasn't even carrying a mask, which is kind of a measure of support that we at least ask that you demonstrate it. Like, we know you don't care, but at least show me you know. And then she was talking on her cell phone. Thank you, Eric. Very nice. Michigan mask he's showing to the camera. But then she's talking on her cell phone. And I thought, I haven't heard any numbers about contact tracing on public transportation in Chicago.
Probably in that situation, I would have gotten off at the next stop and changed cars.
I do that sometimes. But then you sit down and then there's three homeless guys sleeping on the bench and they aren't wearing masks either. I mean, it is a little bit of roulette because she wasn't on the car when I got on.
Ah.
Yeah, I drove in today. I did not want to spend any time on the L. Doesn't it seem to me, and I was going to ask Austin if he remembers what the Michigan data showed, but it seems to me that what we've learned is that being inside is much worse than being outside, that being in sustained contact with people is much worse than being just than passing them by. And so when you have those factors at work, it makes you really wonder about school. It also makes me wonder about some of these outdoor sports that we're canceling. Like, I think that the baseball players that are getting infected not on the field or even necessarily in the locker room, but they're getting infected as they move about through the world. The NBA experiment seems to be kind of a success so far, right? That they have been able to.
Absolutely. Yeah, the NHL and the NBA have had no positive results with the bubbles.
In their bubbles. So that when you're able to control some of these variables, you can really get a grip on this pandemic. So when we're talking about things like school, and we're talking about church, we're talking about political conventions and rallies and so on, it seems like that instead of wearing masks when we pass somebody on a bridge, that seems, I mean, maybe that's a symbolic way of dealing with this, but the real way we do it is to avoid being indoors, avoid this kind of sustained contact, and don't lick doorknobs, right?
This is an especially sore spot for me because right here I'm pointing to my Yadier Molina bobblehead. He tested positive.
You are.
And the Cardinals could ruin the entire MLB season.
Cesspool of contamination.
Yes, it was that's been weighing heavily on me. And you're right. Like, I think the high school outdoor sports stuff hopefully will change because the evidence does seem to be that you can really do it safely if you keep folks outside.
We haven't talked about Kamala Harris being Joe Biden's vice presidential pick. Eric, give us your thoughts on that.
I really like the pick. I think she's really bright. I think she's a really good compliment to him. I have to say, watching her give her speech yesterday, the introductory speech, I had the thought that I'm sure a lot of Americans had, which is this ticket is upside down. That this woman is much more vibrant and feisty and just the kind of person you want running for president.
But here's the good news. We don't have to accept the failed government of Donald Trump and Mike Pence. In just 83 days, we have a chance to choose a better future.
And Biden did not, but Biden looked kind of, you know, like old Uncle Joe. So I really like the pick. I think that I'm glad she's well positioned for 2024 if they win. And I'm all in on that.
Yeah, I think politically, right pick. Conventional wisdom, as far as I know, is that VP picks don't help you very much. They can only hurt you. And even if they do hurt, it's rarely by much that's significant. I agree politically with all the reasons Eric said for why she's a good pick. Not a fan of her policy record. My favorite libertarian propaganda at Reason Magazine has a great story about Kamala's record on the criminal justice front over the last few decades, and it's not good.
Why do you say that?
Well, she, you know, her record as both prosecutor and a DA was constantly, and of course, we don't want to judge people too harshly for changing norms, but even as norms around drug policy and other criminal justice reform issues changed, we often found her using the same sort of law and order rhetoric that we see from the president now. That's how she won her race in 2003, you know, running to the right of kind of a lefty prosecutor. And when she was AG, always had police union support. So that speaks volumes to me.
So maybe though, politically that makes her a good choice, right? I mean, if Donald Trump is the law and order president, Joe Biden has the law and order vice president.
Yeah, I think it's funny because on the far left, that's the criticism of Kamala's. Kamala Harris is a cop. That helps. That helps Joe Biden a great deal if she's seen as that among sort of centrist Democrats.
And I think that she's got enough experience just in terms of being a senator, running a large office as an AG there, that she is a plausible president. She's somebody who could just say, well, you know, if Joe Biden kicks off tomorrow, then she could step in and be president. And I think I said this last week, I didn't get that same vibe from some of the other nominees that they were president ready. And I think that she is. And I think that's reassuring to people who are maybe worried about Biden's age. And I also think that she cuts an amazing contrast with Mike Pence, to the point that I agree with Rex Hupke's column where he's floating the idea that other people have floated too, that Trump may now dump Mike Pence overboard and try to get Nikki Haley to run with him, because she's much more colorful and interesting and vibrant than Mike Pence, who's kind of boring.
So I will violate my 2016 rule of never making predictions and tell you that I will come on this podcast and eat literal crow if Donald Trump tosses Mike Pence from the ticket, simply because that without Mike Pence, that Donald Trump has no hope of hanging on to the white evangelical vote. He is Donald Trump's connection to that community, and that community is critical for Donald Trump if he is even going to have a chance at re-election. I covered Kamala Harris when she was Attorney General of California back in another lifetime. And, you know, Austin is exactly right. She was the law and order candidate who won by sort of running against her former boss being too soft on crime. So, you know, she, like I guess a lot of people have undergone a real sort of transition. But, you know, it seems important to note that everybody has sort of decided that she was the logical choice, the safe choice. And man, I feel a little bit like I'm living in crazy town that we're talking about a Black woman of Indian American heritage who, you know, and that, you know, I think if that doesn't tell you that we are in a totally different world, then I don't know what does. So hold me to that, John.
Yeah, I was just thinking, how do you compare crow and...
I'll look up some recipes. I'm sure there are some good ones.
No, I think you're right. I'm with you. I don't think that'd be interesting, Eric, but I can't imagine that would happen.
Contrast would be really startling when they debate.
Oh, what about so I was thinking, what would the debate be like? I can imagine what the Trump Biden debate would be like, and it's predictable and it'll be sad. And I'll watch it and I'll hate every minute of it. I'm also a little horrified by the idea, but I think it would be much more compelling. A Mike Pence, Kamala Harris debate. I think that would kind of crackle. And in all of these cases, I think it would be better. I'm assuming because there won't be any piped in live audience. There'll be no live studio audience. There'll be no Zoom audience like they do at the NBA games.
So James Fallows of The Atlantic is on record as saying that he does not think any of the debates will happen this year.
I think that Trump thinks highly enough of himself that he thinks that he will have Biden for lunch in a debate. I think he really believes that Biden is severely diminished and that he will have an easy time with him. I think that he, and he also can read the polls and knows that he's behind. I can't imagine that he doesn't want to at least give that a try.
Somebody says, well, Trump can't help himself. I think about how he barely tweeted in the last month or two before the November election, and that he knew that that was, you know, the right play to let sort of, you know, Comey's reopening of the investigation of Clinton to sort of take the headlines. So every time somebody says, well, you know, Trump can't help himself, I don't necessarily buy that.
I thought Biden gave a great speech with Kamala Harris yesterday. He reassured me because I don't think he's given very good speeches. I think Trump could eat him for lunch in the debates, especially if they're not based on truth. Biden has slowed down rhetorically. He's not as whip smart as he used to be. And when I say whip smart, I mean speaking. I don't mean his brain or intelligence. So I think Trump could use the debates to his benefit.
Joe Biden's advisors would be smart to tell him one debate or maybe, to Heather's point, no debates.
I think he agreed to three. He did commit to three. And the thing about these debates is they are very stylized and they tend to be more like joint news conferences, which is why they don't. It's not like these two candidates are sitting on the stage and just going at each other back and forth.
Right.
And it's like you have 90 seconds, you have 60 seconds, and then you have a 30-second rebuttal. And so they have their talking points, and if they're decently rehearsed and don't have huge, you know, brain fades, then generally they kind of end up feeling like a draw. And so, you know, one of my things that I've said on this podcast before is that, you know, I feel like all the times that Trump talks about how Biden is demented and so on, and he says, you know, he doesn't even know he's alive, is something that Trump said about Biden recently. You know, Biden's going to come. Biden may not give the greatest debate performance, but he's going to hit his talking points in all likelihood. He's going to answer the questions. He's going to have a few slips of the tongue, but he'll do fine. And he'll so outperform expectations that Trump will no longer be able to say that he's brain dead. So.
You know, that Trump message is getting
malpractice. You always say the other guy is a great debater and you'll be lucky to make it out of the off the stage alive without blood pouring from all of your orifices. Like, that's how this works. You know what I mean?
I talk to Republicans who are conservative Republicans, but who've given up on Trump, who also say that they think Joe Biden is not mentally fit. So that message that, you know, Trump keeps drumming in, I think, is getting through to people, unfair as it might be. And I think if you're on the debate stage and you've got this vibrant rat-a-tat-tat Trump, whether he's uttering truths or untruths compared to a pensive Biden who is stumbling, I think, I don't know, I'm concerned about that.
You think that that sort of repetition about Kamala Harris is too liberal or too crazy or too angry? That's what they're already doing that, Steve. And I just wonder if, facts be damned, that sort of rhetoric will also have an impact.
Well, that's the thing. She's not liberal. The liberals in the party are pissed because she's not left enough for them. But they just say stuff, whether it's true or not.
I didn't say it was true, Steve. I'm just saying, do you think that that will work?
I think she's shown herself yesterday that she can be very gentle and thoughtful and still sharp as a tack.
And I think that her presence on the ticket will reassure voters who might be worried that Biden is slipping too far, and that they realize that if Biden can't serve out his 4 years, if he is too old, that you have someone, as I said, who is ready to be president. And that, I think that's reassuring. It's not, I think if you had had some of these other names that have been floated out there, that people would not have felt like, yes, I can see her as president. So,
right. You know, it's funny. They talk about the first African American or black woman, the first South Asian woman. I don't know. I haven't heard anyone say yet the first interracial couple running for
both
top
racially
office too.
And religious. Her husband and her stepchildren are Jewish. And so he would be the first second gentleman and also the first Jewish person to be among the first or second families.
Wow, that's going to bring out some people. No, I mean, I don't. I mean that. I mean, yes. I'm just thinking Charlottesville and things like that.
It's, absolutely. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that the Trump couldn't really decide on an attack of Kamala, right? Like at first she was way liberal and then it was, but she's also a cop. So choose one. Like if you're going to do that rat-a-tat-tat, repeat, 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 you got to have a message. And I think perhaps what makes, you know, her such an interesting choice is that she sort of, you know, you can make the argument both ways, right? Because by some accounts, she's the most liberal senator, you know, in the Senate, even more liberal than Bernie Sanders. But if you make that argument, how can you argue that she's also a cop looking to lock up Black and Brown Americans? You know what I mean? Like, you got to pick one. And I don't know that the Trump administration has.
Why not both? .gif. Like, she was in California, she was a cop. And then she got into the Senate, and I think her voting record over the last few years is second only to Elizabeth Warren on.
That's California for you. You can be sort of on the right of California, but also be that still would put you on the left of pretty much anyone else.
Well, and the rap on the nickname they're trying to stick Kamala Harris with is phony. That it's going to be phony Kamala and slow Joe. That's their line of attack. And so phony allows you to say, well, if you think she's liberal, she's a phony. If you think she's a cop, she's a phony. That's the way they're going to try to square that circle.
I am so dismayed by the need to have nicknames. These are adults. I mean, it's so 10-year-old.
My 10-year-old is insulted, John. I wouldn't allow that behavior from her.
I just insulted 10-year-olds everywhere.
I got to tell you, J-Dub, you could not be more right.
Okay. Any last thoughts from anybody as we wrap this podcast up? Eric Zorn, got anything else you want to recommend or say that we didn't say?
No, I'm really interested to see how the school openings go, and I'm hoping that the Catholic schools have it right.
I'm just wondering, are people really listening to the end of these?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they fast forward to this part, Steve.
Oh, good. Okay.
Let's hope for a peaceful, quiet weekend with no more tornadoes and more continued good weather.
I'm looking at my bookshelf, see if I got recommendations. Lolita, you heard of this? Nabokov? Pretty good.
So I just started reading last night this book, and it's it was given to me by Ryan Burrow in the newsroom, and it's called The Wax Pack. Have you heard about it?
No.
Anyone? No. It's a guy who gets a 1984 Topps bubblegum baseball card pack with, I think, 14 players in it. And then he decides to go out and meet each of them around the country to see what they're doing now. Yeah, nice. It's called The Wax Pack. I'm loving it.
It's a true story?
It's nonfiction. The guy's name is he's Armenian. It's Brad Balukjian or something like that. But yeah,
I like so
it's pretty cool. Yeah.
That's a great idea.
I'm about a third of the way through Unacceptable, which is written by two former Wall Street Journal. They may still be at the Journal reporters, and they're talking about the admissions scandal, Stanford and all that. It is fascinating. And the first 100 pages or so aren't about Lori Loughlin. It's about this singer guy that was the mastermind of it all. Fascinating book, Unacceptable.
In case anyone ever goes back to college, you're saying it'd be interesting.
Right.
I know, if there ever is a Stanford again. All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Great seeing you.
Bye.
Well.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.